Hello, I'm Fred Stella, President of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. So, some of you might remember, on occasion I've mentioned that in my other life, when I wear a different hat, I narrate audiobooks. And I had an interesting experience sometime last month. I was in the studio at Amazon, recording a book. It was a book on the mafia, I'm not going to do a show on my book on the mafia. But I was doing that particular book, and I went into the lunchroom, and I saw a friend of mine, Ken, who is a director there. And Ken was having lunch with a young woman, and he introduced me to this woman named Keel, and mentioned that she was doing a book, that she is an author of a book who was recording that book, because occasionally sometimes authors do record their own books. And it was a book, he said, about her life in a Catholic cult. And I said, wait a minute, this sounds like a job for Common Threads. So we had a very fascinating conversation that day and the day after as well. And long story short, this is how I found my guest for this week. She is the author of a book, the book she was recording that day, Holy Unraveled. And her name is Keel Bergen. She is an entrepreneur, activist, mother, author, and filmmaker. She served in leadership roles on the board of directors for several international nonprofit organizations, including Starfish Impact, which have positively changed the lives of tens of thousands of Vietnamese and Guatemalan women. She made her mark in the business world by growing her first company from inception to more than $35 million in 3 years. Keel is the co-founder of Be, a company that curates tribes of women to come together to rebuild their lives and relinquish the patterns of behavior that hold them back. It employs a course correction curriculum for professional advancement, leadership, and personal growth. And you can find out more about Keel's work at www.keel, that's KeeleBurgin.com. And we welcome to Common Threads, Keel. Hello, Keel.
Hi, Fred. It's so good to talk to you again.
Yes, we had a wonderful time recording our respective books together and, of course, finding out all about your really, really fascinating, albeit challenging, life. So you were born into an Irish Catholic family in New Jersey. And anyone, I defy anyone to read the first few chapters of your book and not just feel so brokenhearted over that little girl that has to endure so much. And I've spoken to several people who have had challenging childhoods, because oftentimes a challenging childhood will result in a wonderful life afterwards. But I have to say that reading the accounts of what you went through was particularly heartbreaking. So just give us a little snapshot of what it was like growing up in your particular family.
Sure, I appreciate that. Well, I grew up, as you said, in a Catholic cult sort of setting. So my dad was abusive. He was also a leader of a certain sect of the Charismatic Renewal in the 70s, and he was a leader of that. So the women were pretty much told that they didn't have a voice. So, for example, my mom couldn't color her hair. She had to wear skirts down to her ankles. There were times at the dinner table where I wasn't excused from the dinner table until I could either be slain in the spirit, or I was given the gift of praying in tongues. And I didn't have those gifts, and so I had to fake those gifts to the detriment. If it didn't go right, my dad would get very upset. If he didn't believe it was authentic, he would get very upset. So it was a scary place to grow up. I had my places of solace with some friends and my grandmother and my nanny, But mostly, Fred, I just tried to be invisible. And I would just try not to have a voice. I buried my voice very deep down very early on. And it took me a long time to learn how to use my voice. When I realized that was...
Mm-hmm. What is being slain in the spirit? And if somebody was slain in the spirit for real, if it is in fact a real thing that can happen, what would I see if I was at the dinner table and you were slain in the spirit?
Well, the definition that I heard that I lived with was that the Holy Spirit was coming down and touching you, and that the emotional and physical ramifications of that were so intense that you would fall to the floor.
Okay. Yeah, I think I've seen that in Pentecostal churches where people come up and the pastor taps them on the head, and they've got catchers. They got people who will catch them when they fall. Is that...
That's exactly right.
Okay. So to leave the table, you would have to fall down from the table, fall down from your chair.
Correct. Yeah, to prove that I was full of the Holy Spirit.
Or start speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm. Which was awkward because, to me, I didn't know how to pray in tongues. It just sounded like a language I didn't know. But my father would be the one who would interpret what was said by the sounds that were coming out of people's mouths that weren't in any language that we know of.
So you saw people supposedly speaking in tongues. Did you believe it was a real thing?
To be honest, I was scared of it. I was too little to, understand what was really happening. And I think what was really happening is that my father was after power, and he used God as the person to give him the power. So for me, my dad and God were kind of synonymous, and that was scary because that meant he had God's voice.
Mm. And how did your siblings react to all of this? From what I recall in the book, you seem to get the brunt of the hardcore discipline. How did the others fare?
They fared better. I think that the family unit itself was very discombobulated. We didn't have anyone who was kind of pulling us together. We had these forces that were pulling us apart. But in terms of the level of abuse, and I've done more research on it since I've understood it better in my more adult life, I was the target for my dad. And so I really was the only one that was abused the way I was. And then when I left the house finally at 18, I did have a younger sibling who kind of took over that role, which is unfortunate and sad. But it was, I think we all dealt with it in the way we could. I know my oldest sister went into prayer mode. She just fit in. She would be praying all the time. My next sister was just really withdrawn. And then my younger sister was, I tried to protect her as much as I could. So she was a little more, I guess, protected from that, from seeing that.
But then
none of us, I think the bottom line for me is that none of us were encouraged to find our own voice. We were just treated as a whole.
You mentioned in the book towards the beginning that you changed the names, which I know a lot of people do when they write true accounts like this. So have you changed the names of your family members?
All of them, yes.
Mm. And what kind of relationship do you have with any or all of them right now?
Unfortunately, I don't have any relationship with my parents at all. And I don't have any relationship with my sisters or my brother. I do have a relationship with my youngest brother, who's actually, ironically, not in the book, and his beautiful wife and their kids. So I see them, one brother.
Is there still this association with the charismatic movement with your family?
The beliefs are still there. All of that still exist, but they've all found their different ways to do that. So everyone, all of my sisters, I'm not sure about my brother because I haven't had any contact with him in a long time, how he's raising his kids, but to my knowledge, all of my sisters homeschooled their kids, and there was this philosophy of protect them from the world kind of feeling. And so they were all homeschooled so that they could keep more of that, their beliefs inside contained with their kids.
That is fascinating, including the one sister, the younger sister that you tried to protect.
Correct. Yes, I haven't had much contact with her since I actually divorced years ago. And she said at that point she wanted all of us to be in heaven together, but because I screwed that up by getting a divorce, that she wouldn't really be able to be in contact with me anymore.
Wow. Of course, if you'd gotten an annulment from the Catholic Church, wouldn't that make everything nice again?
I did get an annulment, and I did it for my family, not really for me. But I did get an annulment from that marriage, but I guess it wasn't good. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't good enough. I don't know.
That's absolutely incredible. Now, you told me when we were speaking at the studios that this particular movement that your father was in was at some point excommunicated. Is that correct? Do I remember that right?
Yes. When I was doing my research on that particular community, it did end up being excommunicated from the church for a given amount of time, which I don't exactly know. I want to say it was about 10 years. And then they reconvened, and I've looked it up recently, and it seems that it's not, it seems that women do have their voice there. I don't know because I'm not a part of it, obviously, but it seemed that it was less male-dominated in terms of the rules, and it seemed like it felt like a nicer community to me. But again, I don't know because I'm not in it, obviously. And I want to say too, like, I don't have any grudge against the Catholic Church at all. I think the traditions are beautiful, and I think that it's just not for me.
No, and as we'll talk about later on, you found a tremendous amount of healing through one aspect of the church. I want to just break in for a moment and remind people that they're listening to WGVU. This is Common Threads. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is the author of Holy Unraveled, Kiel Bergen. You refer to this movement, this sect, as the Disciples of Light. I'm not going to ask you what the real name is, but I'm guessing that's not it.
That's correct.
I have to tell you, it did sound kind of made up.
Yeah, well, good.
especially for a Catholic cult. If you'd named it something like the Arrows of Saint Ambrose, I would have bought it.
Right, exactly.
And if you told me that Disciples of Light was the name of some hippie cult, I totally would have believed you that.
maybe that was a hope of mine, but no.
I want to bring up just a couple of the anecdotes because I didn't quite understand when I was reading the book what some of these issues were. What was the problem with you buying, I believe you bought them, red pants, red jeans? What? And it's kind of like you knew that you did something wrong. Why was that wrong? I just can't wrap my head around it.
I mean, my simple answer, Fred, is that I don't really know. The rules were never that clear inside of my house. And so that was probably one of the most damaging things, is because I didn't know how to navigate inside of that. So red pants might be okay one day. My sister had come home with blue pants the week before, so I was kind of hopeful that maybe the red would be okay, but it wasn't, and it definitely wasn't okay that I did it. And it was because red pants would be seen as worldly. They would be seen as materialistic. They would be seen as trendy or, or something you're not allowed to do if you love God that much.
I see. So it certainly had nothing to do with modesty whatsoever. It was just considered a bit too flamboyant. Kind of like now you're telling me that kind of like an Amish mindset.
I think that's probably accurate, yeah.
Hmm, okay.
Women are not meant to be really, weren't really meant to be looked at. You know, there were all these conversations that I would hear about, you know, which person I was going to be married off to, which were really scary, but you weren't supposed to be noticed.
Right. Unless you were noticed by the person they were setting you up with. Yeah, this is another thing I'd never heard of in any Catholic culture or subculture in the United States. Arranged marriages. They had their eye on some guy for you. Am I correct?
Yes. Someone I was horrified to have contact with. Yeah, not let's just say not my type. But it was another leader's son who this was happening, and both my older sisters were also going to be with that same leader's, one of their sons.
And did
so
that
I think none of that happened.
Okay.
No.
Did your sisters actually choose their own spouses?
Everyone in my family did, yes. Yes. My father ended up having all of us leave that particular group because he got in a fight with the other leader, which often happens, I would assume. Mm-hmm. And he went off and started kind of his own thing. And that was when I was a bit older, and so I wasn't part of his new one.
I see. How did you handle, how did you navigate your friendships as a small child living in a situation like that? Were all of your friends a part of that? Were you encouraged to have friends within that sect as opposed to friends outside the sect? Were you allowed to hang out with Protestants and Jews? You know, all of that.
No, we were not. I really appreciate that question because it was formative for my childhood. I was only allowed to be with and be friends with the people who were in that community. And if I had friends outside of that, they were a secret. There was even a point of time where my parents didn't want us to be with my grandparents because they weren't in it. And so it was very secret, you know, it was very select. If you were either in this community or you were out, and that was it. And I didn't orient that way because I really wanted to know about the world. I wanted to be out there. I wanted to listen to music and hear what the top 40 was. But we weren't allowed to do any of that. No TV, no radio, no opinions, none of that. That's why you'll read in the book, Grace, my friend who was in the community, was so important to me because her family was normal. You know, they could have sugar and watch TV and they were allowed to listen to the radio. And I remember like listening to Top 40 in her room and her mom would walk in and I would jump, but I didn't have to because her mom was like, no, this isn't what normal kids do your age, is they listen to the radio and Casey Kasem Top 40, you know?
Right.
So.
But you went to a Catholic school. Correct?
I went to a Catholic school the way through college, yes.
Yeah, and so you obviously interacted in school with Catholic kids who were more normal Catholic.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like you could be friends with them during the day, but it might be a challenge to be friends with them on weekends and such, and to do
right.
things with them that they would do, that would be...
That's right. And I remember coming to, you know, going to some birthday parties and things like that. But the main thing was you resided inside of this community.
Mm-hmm. You're very open about the sexual assault that you endured in your book. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's also another very, very painful account to read, but it's so important to how you became the person you were and obviously are now. And you were the man who did that to you was also part of this community, am I correct?
No, he was not part of the community. He was part of the community my dad was trying to build after he left that one.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
My
dad was trying to recruit his dad into this community.
I see. Okay. So, but I do know that there was this, he had the seal of kosher approval to be someone that your parents would approve of.
Correct. He was the only boy I was allowed out with. He was really the only person I was allowed out with, because we had left the community. And so I had, consequently, those friends weren't allowed to be my friends anymore, which was awkward too, because they were, you know, it was from one extreme to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden my dad was trying to recruit new people into the community. And so I was only allowed to be with that particular, man, really, during that year.
You say man, how old was he? I forget. He was a teenager still, wasn't he, or no?
He was 17, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He was 17, I was 15, yeah.
Okay. And what's so terribly painful about reading this is that your mother just didn't even want to think about it. Even when, again, this is one of those things in the book I'm reading and I'm not quite exactly sure if I'm reading it correctly. You're in the doctor's office. Your mother is there. The doctor is there. The doctor indicates, from what the way you write it, quite clearly, you were assaulted. Sex was forced upon you. And yet your mother, it didn't register with your mother? Or help me out here.
I'm a mother myself. I don't know if I can help you with that answer, except to know that that was probably the wound that took me the longest to heal from, because she just went somewhere else. She was in denial that that could ever happen. Or maybe she was afraid that she would have to do something about it. And I wish I knew. Like, I wish that we had the relationship where we could talk about it. We talked about it once, and she just said she remembered and admitted and said, I never want to talk about that again. I don't know. I don't know how that could be, to be honest. How you could have your daughter laying there and in a lot of pain emotionally and physically and not be there. I don't know.
Yeah.
I wish I had that answer.
I reread that part, that page or portion of the page a couple of different times, and I was going like, what? Not quite getting something, and I would expect, oh, maybe in a couple of pages it'll all come out, and of course it never does. You close that chapter and move on to something else, and I always it was disappointing, of course, to see your mother react like that. And your father, did he ever get wind of it? To your knowledge,
when I talked to my mom about it. I was probably 30, and she said she didn't want to talk about it, that she and my dad just wanted to not talk about it, and they're sorry that any of that ever happened. But it was more of like a, we're really sorry that happened to you, we're not going to talk about it anymore. So that's my only indication that my dad did know, but I don't know.
Hmm.
I wish I knew. I wish, and I want this for all abuse victims, that There's a power in silence, and there's a price to silence, and they have different. I feel like you can have different relationships with silence, but for abuse victims, oh, if they could just find someone to talk to, and decide, and really get that feeling of it wasn't my fault, because it took me decades to realize that that wasn't my fault. And if I had had some, if I had had a parent who said, you did nothing to deserve that, and we're going to fight and we're going to press charges or whatever, it would have been so, it would have changed my life so much. And it would have alleviated so much pain if I had had that kind of person to talk to who would have walked me through that guilt and the shame and the absolute embarrassment and thinking it was my fault.
This account that you give certainly gives more credence to the question that so many people are asking today. Why didn't she come forward then? When you hear about these assaults that took place, you know, a decade, 2 decades ago, whenever it was, and people always kind of cock their eyebrow, like, well, boy, if that happened to me, I would just run to the cops, or I do this, or I do that. Sometimes it's just not the option of the moment, is it?
Well, I applaud those people who run to the police. I say hats off. For me, and I think for a lot of people who have been through similar tragedy and trauma, is you internalize first. What did I do wrong? And given the way I was raised, which was you don't have an opinion or a voice, you know, that wasn't really an option for me to say, hey, I'm going to stand up. Look what happened to me. That just didn't occur to me, especially when my mom saw me, physically saw the pain and didn't identify it or come to me and ask about it. Then I was sure it had to be my fault. I must have done something. And if I could change that for the people who have been abused or hurt that way, that would be amazing. And that's part of why I wrote Holy Unraveled, because I want to hear the stories that people don't want to say out loud. Because once we say them out loud, we can heal. But until we say them, they're just stuck inside of us, and they become a different story. They don't a darker story. And if we can all just say those things that we don't want to say out loud, just here I go, and it's scary, but it is so healing and so liberating as well.
Keel, I have to stop you right there because we're out of time, but of course this is a fascinating conversation, and I'd like to continue it next week if you have time.
Oh, I'd be honored. That would be fantastic.
You've been listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. Keel Bergen has been my guest, and she is the author of Holy Unraveled.
Oh, I'd be honored. That would be fantastic.
You've been listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. Keel Bergen has been my guest, and she is the author of Holy Unraveled.